It is my pleasure to introduce Peter Slade. Peter Slade came to the University of Virginia Graduate School by way of the University of Mississippi's Department of Southern History and its Center for the Study of Southern Culture. Peter did his undergraduate degree at St. Andrews in Scotland, wrote an undergraduate thesis on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. His interest in theology and race in the South led him to Oxford, Mississippi. Not Oxford, England, but Oxford, Mississippi, where Pete worked and developed skills in documentary film and in documentary studies, wrote a master's thesis there on the University of Mississippi Gospel Choir, and was part of the University of Mississippi Gospel Choir. And if you don't mind, I'll say that the year, I'm not sure this is because of your presence, maybe it was, the year you left, it was the year, your last year with the choir, you were nominated the choir for a Grammy Award. So the whole University of Mississippi choir flew out to LA, went to the Grammys, parties with, you know, Clapton, and anyway. And then Pete came up to Virginia and was one of the first PhD graduates in the Live Theology program here. He is now a professor of theology and ethics at Ashland University in Ohio. Pete's dissertation, a Theology of Open Friendship, which you'll speak to us from today, will be out with Oxford University Press, following in the footsteps of Reverend Dr. Wills in September. So thanks for being here. We look forward to your presentation.
Mind crash. Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, Charles. It was all Charles's fault that I came here. I told this story to a couple of people the other day. I was his gardener by way of supplementing my student stipend, and one of his sons came out to me once as I was rooting around in the dirt and said, does my dad pay you all your money? And so he was a gracious patron in those days and continues to be so. I want to talk this morning about an organization called Mission Mississippi. And you read, or you may have read, this is like in class. I ask my students, okay, who did the reading for today? Okay, so, well, that one. But if I'm vaguely interesting, you may want to look at an article I included in the Silt packet. I realize I'm new to this game. As I woke up at the crack of dawn this morning to figure out what I was going to say today, I thought, you fool, why did you send that into the packet? That could have been your presentation this morning. So I studied this organization, Mission Mississippi, that's going to be in this soon-to-be-published book. And I think it might be interesting for us because studying this organization raises many of the issues we've been talking about over the last couple of days. These are questions of, I mean, broadly, I guess, our concern is the legacy of Dr. John Perkins. And this is studying this organization raises some issues about that. Raises issues about the racial reconciliation movement in the evangelical church, and more specifically, the role of justice in that pursuit, and the importance or not of multicultural congregations in this struggle for justice and reconciliation. Charles did a little bit of a bio on me, the story of how I, a white Englishman, I recognize that about myself. how I came to study Mission Mississippi is too long and convoluted a tale, really, to tell here. When I lived in England, I was involved in church-based community development work that practiced, I realized, I was thinking about it, at least two of John Perkins' R's, relocation and redistribution. And so when I came to John Perkins' writings and hearing him speak, lots of what he was saying sounded very familiar and resonated with my own experience in ministry. And also, before I left the UK, I'd experienced being welcomed into Black British church communities, West Indian immigrant communities, worshiping in those churches, and to the surprise of the gospel choir in Mississippi, I sang in a gospel choir in England. They didn't believe such things existed, but I did. And then after moving from the University of Mississippi, while in Mississippi, I did have the privilege of being mentored by Susan Glisson. I worked with her in the what would become the Center for William Winter Center for Racial Reconciliation. So she isn't here to hear that shout out, but oh well. And then while I was here at UVA, I worshipped for 6 years with some of you here, Melissa, Aiko, at Trinity Episcopal Church, which is a historically black congregation here in Charlottesville that made the decision a few years ago, maybe a decade ago, to welcome whites into that congregation. And so I had first-hand experience in that congregation of some of the struggles and issues that are raised in a multicultural congregation. Well, in 2003, I was down in Jackson, and my dissertation went up in flames. That was my first dissertation. I called Charles on the phone. I said, "Charles, my dissertation has just gone up in flames." And he told me, "You should write on Mission Mississippi. That's the real story."
It literally go up in flames.
No, not really. No, it flushed down the toilet was actually probably. But as I was trying to figure out what metaphor I'd use here this morning, I thought that was up in flames was better. Or blown up in my face. It just got shut down. It's a very sad story, and I'll tell you some other time. And I knew about Mission Mississippi from the time I'd lived in the state, but also because I'd done field work and research for Charles for his beloved community book. As you may have read in my brief introduction to the organization in the packet, Mission Mississippi seems to be a classic product of the 1990s boom in white evangelicals' interest in racial reconciliation. And that's what's so nicely outlined in Emerson and Smith's book, Divided by Faith, published in 2000. That's the book that was mentioned by Dr. Sanders at the beginning of her talk yesterday. I have a bag here of sociologists, so I'll pull it out. This is like visual aids. There's a purpose to this. So, Divided by Faith. As Dr. Sanders mentioned in her talk yesterday, Emerson and Smith identify Tom Skinner, Sam Hines, and John Perkins as the pioneers of the African-American prophetic call for racial reconciliation. What Emerson and Smith found, and I'm sure many of us have experienced, that when the message of these prophets of racial reconciliation is adopted by white evangelicals, or when it moves into that world, it loses something in translation. What it loses specifically is a critique of systemic injustice. And Emerson and Smith, in their book, and I really think this is an excellent book, try and account for this. They tell us it is because white evangelicals, their cultural toolkits are skewed by what they call accountable free will individualism. Now, this free will individualism is built into white America's DNA. And it finds expression in the American dream. The American dream that Obama exploited so successfully in his stump speeches, right? He is the embodiment of the American dream that the individual can, if they work hard enough, do anything in America. What Emerson and Smith found using their cunning sociologist surveys was that white evangelicals have drunk from this Kool-Aid in larger doses than the average Joe six-pack. So stick to Bud Light, don't drink Kool-Aid. Strange conclusion. What they found was white evangelicals test out as even more individualistic than your average white American. The result, so they argue, is that this accountable free will individualism renders white evangelicals almost incapable of seeing America's racialized society and the resultant injustice as anything other than a problem of individual sin, the sin of racism. The result is a message of racial reconciliation that, to quote them, is this. Become a Christian, love your individual neighbors, establish a cross-race friendship, give individuals the right to pursue jobs and individual justice without discrimination by other individuals, and also forgiveness of individuals one has wronged. The rather depressing conclusion of this book is that despite black and white evangelicals' best intentions, when they pursue racial reconciliation, the result was that black and white evangelicals become more divided from each other. Whites less able to see systemic injustice, and African Americans more convinced of it. It's with their work that was had recently been published when Charles said Mission Mississippi, that's the story, that I went to study Mission Mississippi. And Mission Mississippi really seems to be a poster child for what they're describing, evangelicals talking about racial reconciliation. Mission Mississippi has its origins in an organization called the Christian Businessmen's Committee of Jackson, who, at the suggestion of evangelist Pat Morley, wanted to hold a large evangelistic stadium rally in the city. The Christian Businessmen's Committee are kind of the Rotarians at prayer, meet once a month or every 2 weeks at lunchtime. The white businessmen drag their unsuspecting white businessmen colleagues from their office along, and they get presented with the gospel. This is kind of what they do. I'm not mocking it. And one of their evangelists was Pat Morley, and he suggested to them that he could come back and, with their help, could hold a large evangelistic stadium rally in the city, kind of, you know, Billy Graham style. Fortunately, the Christian businessmen were not completely blind to the realities of Jackson. They realized that with the city being half the population being African-American, a white evangelist backed by white evangelical businessmen wouldn't reach the city. And so they thought this was a way of fobbing this guy off. They said, I'm sorry, we can't do it. But Morley suggested that that he lead this mission with Tom Skinner, his friend Tom Skinner. So again, tapping into the narrative of Emerson and Smith. This is at the time of Promise Keepers. So holding large-scale stadium rallies with black and white speakers calling for racial reconciliation was very much part of the scene at that time. And so some of these businessmen called an interest meeting. They sent out general invitations. And to this interest meeting came... in addition to these businessmen, two important groups. One was a number of African-American pastors from the city who'd been part of an interracial ministers group. And the other constituency that turned up were people connected with Voice of Calvary, John Perkins's the ministry that he founded. And so they had this big stadium rally, one of the focal points of which was the ministers raising a huge cross, kind of like the flag on Iwo Jima, up in the middle of the stadium. And it was deemed a success. And for 4 years, Mission Mississippi organized these kind of large... They moved from the stadium to a coliseum. Their appeal became more selected. And they held these annual reconciliation stadium events. Mission Mississippi is truly ecumenical. It includes mainline Protestants and Catholics. They're well represented. However, the dominant influence is conservative evangelicals. It's clearly visible in the statement of faith. They took their statement of faith from Chuck Colson. And you can see it in their choice of speakers in those rallies in the 1990s, alongside Skinner and Morley. Coach McCartney of Promise Keepers spoke. Their last one, they had international evangelist Josh McDowell speak. But they also invited Chuck Colson and James Dobson when I was going through their files, and these guys were unable to attend. But from the start, though, alongside this organizing of big rallies, there was a sense that really this was a movement and not simply a series of events. The original board, and a few people told me this story, that when they started meeting, They called for a commitment. This is a long-term project, they said. We're calling for a commitment of 20 years from the people present here to be a part of this work of racial reconciliation. And the emphasis, really thanks to Tom Skinner, had always been on participants entering into intentional interracial relationships. And in these interracial relationships, having the hard conversations about race. And that's where they get their slogan from, changing Mississippi one relationship at a time. In 1997, the board appointed a new director, and the rallies came to an end. The attendance had been dwindling. Instead, the focus shifted to creating opportunities for dialogue, encouraging church partnerships, and taking Mission Mississippi out of Jackson and making it a statewide organization, which it has now become. Mission Mississippi is quite clear that it's about preaching Christians' unity in Christ and bringing Christians together across racial and denominational lines. And that's no small task anywhere in America, but in the racially segregated and hyper-sectarian world of Mississippi, this is a very tricky task. And to do this, Mission Mississippi carefully avoids what they call political issues. They do not talk about justice. You will not find the word justice in their literature. And they do not call for the integration of church congregations. This is part of their strategy. But they claim to be changing Mississippi one relationship at a time. It's tempting to throw out this whole language of individual relationships and friendships as being hopelessly problematic when dealing with issues of injustice in a racialized society. And that would seem to be what Emerson and Smith conclude in this book. So this is the organization that I went to study. But I was trying to do lived theology. I was one of the first graduates from the Lived Theology program, so I felt, you know, some obligation to try and figure out how you actually did this thing and what it was. So I needed to pay attention to this part of the body of Christ, not dismiss them, and reflect theologically on their lived experience of incarnating Christ in their particular situation. When I first started thinking about Mission Mississippi in this way, thinking about this slogan, changing Mississippi one relationship at a time, I realized that I needed to think more about a theology of friendship. And so I went to the friendship section in the library. There is one, when you can figure out where it is. It's quite small, so that was good. I was a bit worried. I started scanning through the books on the shelves, and I didn't know what I was looking for. In a small edited volume called The Changing Face of Friendship, I stumbled on a chapter by theologian Jürgen Moltmann called Open Friendship, Aristotelian and Christian Concepts of Friendship. I later found out that this was a slightly reworked section from Moltmann's 1975 book called The Church and the Power of the Spirit. In this chapter, Moltmann spins an ecclesiology around the notion of a radical open friendship of the disciples of Jesus, which contrasts with the closed friendships of the closed societies of the 20th century. Well, I practically started shouting right there in the stacks, because historian and troublemaker James Silver described Mississippi as the closed society in his 1964 book, Mississippi, the Closed Society. So before I wrote a word of my dissertation, I had the title, Open Friendship in a Closed Society, which is the title of the book. So with the title, right, there was no stopping me. So I started reading Moltmann, and by an extraordinary coincidence and completely unknown to me at the time, Charles had invited Moltmann to lead the Spring Institute here in 2005. So I was actually able to sit down and talk with him in person about this. Well, the more I read, it seemed to me that Moltmann's notion of open friendship seemed, at least superficially, to look a lot like what Mission Mississippi was preaching, and his description of closed societies described what they were up against in Mississippi. So I'm going to briefly sketch out Moltmann's theology of open friendship. Key to his understanding of open friendship and closed societies is the Christian hope, which has the eschatological horizon of the resurrection of Jesus. This hope opens the individual to engage with even the toughest, the seemingly most hopeless situations. Those with this hope are open to their neighbors and the future. Individuals and societies without this hope, on the other hand, face the future and the challenges of their neighbors with fear. Such individuals, churches, and societies condemn themselves to a slow death because, quote, for what closes itself within itself is condemned to death and has a deadly effect on other life. The church must open itself not simply to the possibilities of the future, but also open itself to those who are different, particularly those who suffer. Why? Because, quote, this is what God has done in the cross of Jesus Christ. In his book, The Crucified God, Moltmann employs the dialectical principle that truth is only revealed in its opposite to understand the cross. Moltmann explains that God is only revealed as God in his opposite, godlessness and abandonment by God. And this is what he finds at the heart of the story of the crucifixion. Moltmann explains the ramifications of this for Christian theology in a beautifully simple and profound passage. I'll read it to you. In concrete terms, God is revealed in the cross of Christ, who is abandoned by God. His grace is revealed in sinners. His righteousness is revealed in the unrighteous, and in those without rights, and his gracious election in the damned. The deity of God is revealed in the paradox of the cross. This makes it easier to understand what Jesus did. It was not the devout, but the sinners, not the righteous, but the unrighteous who recognized him, because in them he revealed the divine righteousness of grace and the kingdom. He revealed his identity amongst those who had lost their identity, amongst the lepers, sick, rejected, and despised, and was recognized as the Son of Man amongst those who'd been deprived of their humanity. End quote. The implication of this revelation of God in the God-forsaken dictates the way that the church should approach its missionary proclamation of the gospel. If a being is revealed only in its opposite, Moltmann reasons, then the church, which is the church of the crucified Christ, cannot consist of an assembly of like persons who mutually affirm each other, but must be constituted by unlike persons. In Moltmann's continued exploration of this challenge to the church, he discovers in the gospel account a description of the very openness he sees as the result of hope in the crucified and risen Christ. It's the friendship of Jesus. Friend, argues Moltmann, should become one of the church's titles for Jesus alongside prophet, priest, and king. And the church should again become the friends of Jesus as well as the communion of saints. Jesus is called friend on two occasions in the gospels. In two of the synoptic accounts, Jesus compares his reception to that of John the Baptist. While John had been criticized for his strict asceticism, now the Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. That's in Luke chapter 7, verse 34. Moltmann sees this friendship, the radical openness to the other that a closed society is bound to condemn. This extension of friendship towards those deemed antisocial gains its energy, according to Moltmann, from Jesus' eschatological vision of the messianic feast of the kingdom. In the second instance, found in the Gospel of John, Jesus proclaims to his disciples that they are now no longer servants, but friends. That's John 15, 15. And that's no easy designation. You're no longer servants, but friends. Jesus indicates the important cost of such a statement by linking friendship with the greatest possible human love for us. As Jesus explains, no one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Moltmann writes, when he cites friendship as the motive for Jesus' sacrificing his life, John means a love that sees, that is faithful unto death. He means a knowing sacrifice for the sake of a friend's lives. Through Jesus' death in friendship, the disciples become friends forever, and they remain in his friendship if they follow his commandments and become friends to others. The disciples must now participate in the prefiguring of the messianic banquet. They too must be known as the friends of tax collectors and sinners if they're to be friends of Jesus. The motivation for the friends of Jesus to extend friendship to the God-forsaken and the sinner is not a masochistic practice of self-denial, a trade-off for some delayed cosmic reward. No, the motive comes from the overflowing joy of God. In John, it says that my joy may be in you, says Jesus. Moltmann calls this hopeful, joyful, risky friendship of Jesus and his friends open friendship. Well, is Mission Mississippi preaching this kind of open friendship? Well, one must deduce or even construct Mission Mississippi's theology of friendship from its practices rather than any explicit theological statements. Mission Mississippi clearly differentiates between the friendships participants already have and those that they deliberately enter into across racial and denominational lines. Dolphus Weary, the executive director of Mission Mississippi, calls these intentional relationships and talks of participants needing intentionality in maintaining practices that nurture these relationships. As Dan Hall, a regular speaker at Mission Mississippi events, explained, that intentionality is required because unlike the friends we make easily, quote, interracial relationships are just hard. They're bloody, they're difficult, and lead to hard conversations. And that's been what we've been hearing at this conference. Perhaps Mission Mississippi's talk of intentional relationships rather than friendships comes from an unconscious recognition of the power that private friendships wield in a closed society. The open friendship that Moltmann identifies as Christ's calling for his disciples, quote, does not know the privacy and intimacy of modern friendship. Moltmann insists to live in Christ's friendship today requires friendship be deprivatized. Friendship must once again receive the character of public protection and of public respect for others. Mission Mississippi's use of the word relationship contains both the public and private senses of friendship. Because after all, you can have business relationships as well as personal relationships that Moltmann would have Christians reclaim. Well, the question is then whether such a theology of friendship is robust enough to address systemic issues of injustice, and even robust enough to change whites, particularly white evangelicals' perception of Mississippi's racialized society. The key thing I had to explore was why Mission Mississippi left this language of justice off the agenda. I mean, it's a huge problem, right? Hugely problematic. And my interviews with participants tended to confirm Emerson and Smith's findings that whites are less able, aware, and inclined to recognize systemic injustice than their African-American brothers and sisters in Christ. Lee Paris is a white businessman and chair of Mission Mississippi. He chaired it for 15 years. He's one of these original founders. He's a member of First Presbyterian Church, a large PCA church in Jackson. It was one of the flagship congregations when that denomination split from the more liberal PCUS in 1973. And actually, that church, this Presbyterian church, provided a significant proportion of the white leadership for Mission Mississippi, which is curious for those of you who are familiar with the PCA. When I asked this guy, Lee Paris, about the absence of the word justice in any of Mission Mississippi's literature, he said, and you've got this part of this quote in the packet, "For me, justice is God's job and the law of our land's job. And I guess that's not a calling on my life to seek justice." You can just hear kind of Perkins freaking out in the background. "I guess that's not a calling on my life to seek justice. That's God's job and the law's." Well, this worldview is deeply informed by a Southern Presbyterian doctrine called the spirituality of the church. And in my book, I go into excruciating detail, probably, tracing the history of this doctrine and showing how it developed in defense of slavery and then in the preservation of Jim Crow, tracing its roots to antebellum theologian James Henley Thornwell, who declared, quote, "The provinces of the church and state are perfectly distinct, and the one has no right to usurp the jurisdiction of the other. The state looks to the visible and outward. The church is concerned for the invisible and inward. They are planets moving in different orbits." In the Southern Presbyterian resistance to the call to repent for its support of Jim Crow racism through the 20th century, this became an issue because there was a movement to reunite with the Northern Presbyterians. And every time they tried to do it, the Northern Presbyterians would say, "You need to address this question of segregation." And this is the reaction they got. They clung onto this doctrine of the spirituality of the church, which came to mean that the church could not address the state, and it couldn't endorse or condemn society's programs. So I'm a Northern Presbyterian. I say to you, do something about Jim Crow. I say, well, whether or not I need to do something about Jim Crow, you have no business as a church telling me to do this. In fact, you're not the church. That's not the church's business. A very clever defense. So it's not really too surprising that the white leaders of Mission Mississippi wanted to avoid the issue of justice. The white conservative Presbyterians even have a time-worn doctrine to back up a natural disinclination to address the issue. But what was most surprising to me, I mean, I wasn't that surprised to find that the whites didn't really want to talk about justice or redistribution. What was most surprising to me was why the African-American leaders went along with it, particularly when I realized how many of them were personally mentored by John Perkins. Foremost among these leaders, I've already mentioned his name, is Dolphus Weary. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with him. He was the executive director from 97 to 2005 of Mission Mississippi, and he's now the president. He grew up, his story is very similar and deeply connected with Perkins' story. He grew up poor, sharecropping in a small hamlet 2 miles outside Mendenhall, Mississippi. And in 1963, at the age of 17, Weary accepted an invitation to a tent revival meeting run by Voice of Calvary. That evening, Weary responded to the evangelist's message and became one of the young men discipled by John Perkins. After he's one of the smart, you know, why do you only pay attention to the smart kids that Perkins was talking about yesterday. After completing his bachelor's and master's degree in Christian education in California at the Los Angeles Baptist College, Weary returned to Mendenhall to work with Voice of Calvary. When Perkins left Mendenhall for Jackson in 74, Weary took over as director of programs. In 78, under his leadership, Voice of Calvary in Mendenhall became autonomous from Voice of Calvary in Jackson. Weary became president and executive director of the renamed Mendenhall Ministries, which I'm sure many of you are familiar. In 97, he accepted the position as Mission Mississippi's executive director. And that's what marked the end of the stadium rallies and big name speakers. In fact, the first large gathering Mission Mississippi had after he was appointed, he had John Perkins as the main speaker. Well, this might be anomalous. But another significant African-American leader in Mission Mississippi is a minister called Thomas Jenkins. He's pastor of New Dimensions Ministry in Jackson. And has been involved in Mission Mississippi since its start. He came under the influence of Perkins while majoring in accounting at Jackson State. And if you know the way Perkins operates, this will make a lot of sense to you. He saw a bright young man who was doing accounting. How can I use him? Thought John Perkins. He had Jenkins keep the books for Voice of Calvary. All the time, Perkins was filling his ear, bending his mind. When Jenkins graduated, Perkins, always keen to develop African-American leadership and economic development, connected him with an African-American priest in Louisiana named Father Albright McKnight, who had started the Southern Cooperative Development Fund. Jenkins returned to Jackson to work out of an office where, in Perkins' building, as the regional director of the Southern Cooperative Development Fund for Mississippi, Kentucky, South Carolina, and Alabama. And Perkins took full advantage of such easy access to his protege and the development fund. Jenkins told me, we were able to help Voice of Calvary buy houses and renovate houses. And where we could get capital to the Mendenhall ministry, we did a lot of stuff. And not only with them, but with lots of other people as well. The numerous connections between the radical Voice of Calvary and Mission Mississippi are striking. Not only Thomas Jenkins, but also Nettie Winters. He replaced Dolphus as Mission Mississippi's executive director in 2005. And Ronnie Crudup, who's the vice chairman of Mission Mississippi's board, they've all served as chairs of the board of Voice of Calvary Ministries. These men were also involved in an organization called Hope Community Credit Union. So they're very keyed into issues of community development. This guy, Nettie Winters, the new executive director in 2005, became the pastor for Voice of Calvary Fellowship last year. He's holding those two positions. So what are these guys doing running a racial reconciliation initiative that's silent on the question of justice and does not call for churches to integrate their monoracial congregations? I mean, I think it's quite puzzling. When Dolphus Weary started at Mission Mississippi, in his letter accepting the post, he explained, once the bridge is built between us and God, there are other bridges that need to be built. Three specifically that I'm concerned about are the bridge that crosses the race gap, the economic gap, and the denomination gap. 3 years later, in a conversation with me, Weary no longer pushed Mission Mississippi to build bridges over the economic gap. He said, in my life prior to Mission Mississippi, we did a lot of preaching in terms of trying to get reconciliation between the haves and the have-nots. Now, after deciphering from the board what their vision is, my relationship with Mission Mississippi is more pointed. It's more specific. It has the boundary of the Christian community, and it has the boundary of racial reconciliation and denominational reconciliation. He dropped the economic demands. And I understand what they're doing is both extremely, as I thought about this, is extremely pragmatic, but it's also profoundly theological. It's pragmatic in this way. For the African-American leaders of the movement with a commitment to grassroots community development, this slogan, one relationship at a time, is the first step in a strategy to access and mobilize the economic and social capital of the white church. But it's theological too. They're placing a hope in the transformative power of Christian friendship, in Moltmann's open friendship. And they're not without their critics. The chief amongst them is, of course, John Perkins. He kicked off quite a scene in one of the early board meetings with Dolphus Weary as chair. But Dolphus Weary calls what Mission Mississippi does, he calls this approach Reconciliation 101. And Mission Mississippi's simple task is to start the process of reconciliation by getting people together to talk. He leaves questions of integrating your church, reparations, etc., out of the issue. But this Reconciliation 101 is this placing faith in open friendship. What Jenkins, Winters, Weary hope, and I mean that in a theological sense, what they hope is that this process of conversation will move people deeper into reconciliation, move people into issues of justice through these their eyes being opened in these relationships. Mission Mississippi has now been going for 15 years. I'd say that Mission Mississippi is a very quiet revolution with a very long-term strategy. Now, it's perhaps easy to dismiss Mission Mississippi, especially here as we focus on the legacy of John Perkins. But Mission Mississippi is the legacy of John Perkins just as much as CCDA. It was really only possible for this organization to start in Jackson because of the years of prophetic witness and influence of Voice of Calvary and the Reconcilers Fellowship. And it's currently helmed by John's closest disciples. This isn't a case, as outlined by Emerson and Smith, of the Gospel's call for justice having been lost in translation. These guys know this very well. In the book, my final chapter takes seriously Mission Mississippi's claim that intentional interracial intercessory prayer, that's a mouthful, intentional interracial intercessory prayer, is the key to this work. And you've read a shortened version of that chapter in the packet, if you cared to. And one of the strengths of Mission Mississippi's regular prayer meetings is that it builds up a network of Christians committing themselves to racial reconciliation without expending energy on either trying to integrate monoracial congregations or establishing new multiracial congregations. And I think for us here, this really isn't something I develop in my book, but I think it's worth us considering. I think that's very important. This is where my bag comes in handy. Michael O. Emerson, co-author of Divided by Faith, has been responsible for a subsequent series of sociological studies. I must alliterate, I don't know, it just comes to me naturally. Studies of multiracial congregations. And I think they tell an interesting story, these books. I got them here. I decided to bring them. I think they tell an interesting story, but it's not one that Emerson intends. This slew of books by sociologists on multiracial congregations and racial reconciliation all seem to advocate for multiracial congregations. However, that conclusion seems to fly in the face of their own findings in the book. It's quite odd. So Divided by Faith has the particular grim conclusion, and we've got a particularly grim cover here, right? That evangelicals, despite their best intentions, make America's racialized society more divided and more segregated. Bad evangelicals. The one glimmer of hope was the idea that it's not in individual friendships, but in interracial networks that whites start to lose their blinders to systemic injustice. Aha, thought Emerson. I'm imagining, I don't know what he said. Aha, thought Emerson. Then the way to fix the problem of white evangelicals is multicultural congregations. Multicultural congregations are these networks. So this is followed up by, a bit depressing, so let's go cheerful. You've got a chapter of this in your book, in the course packet. United by Faith, where Emerson is joined by Curtis Paul DeYoung, George Yancey, and Karen Chai Smith, Kim. United by Faith, in which the team of sociologists issue a challenge at the end. We're calling for a movement in the church towards multiracial congregations. Why? Because in the a very ambitious subtitle, it says the multiracial congregation as an answer to the problem of race, right? So they're calling on congregations, Christians, to form multiracial congregations. However, as these sociologists continued to study multiracial congregations, the conclusions and the covers became more subdued. Against all odds. Again, Emerson, Brad Christensen, and Corey L. Edwards. The title, Against All Odds, pretty much sums up the conclusion of this study of six multiracial congregations, that interracial organizations and congregations are inherently unstable. That's what they found. And many so-called multiracial congregations are simply transitioning. In fact, they couldn't find a congregation that wasn't doing that to do this study. They found that all of their congregations were problematic or transitioning. Despite these findings, Emerson continued to make massive claims for multiracial congregations. In his most recent book, Back to Rainbows. Back to Rainbows. No, that's my comeback album. Despite these findings, Emerson continued to make these massive claims. In People of the Dream, he claims that multiracial congregations are harbingers of what is to come in U.S. race relations. Not simply a sort of prophetic witness, but really, this is where it's at. This is bringing in the change. The problem with his thesis and hope for multicultural congregations as the harbingers of change in our racialized society is his own findings. Emerson estimates that only 7% of American congregations are multiracial. 7%. Even this is probably an inflated figure, as a number of these congregations are in transition. For the conversation we're having here, what's really significant amongst these 7% of American congregations, only a minority, only 34% of those multiracial congregations contain a significant percentage of blacks and whites in the same congregation. He comes to this conclusion in an honest part of this book. That's the whole book's very honest. But he says congregations in the United States are hyper-segregated. The average level of racial diversity in congregations is near zero, and the average level of segregation between congregations is near perfect. And he starts busting myths. Conservative Protestants, amongst whom evangelicals fall, are the least likely to be racially diverse, lagging behind mainline Protestants and far behind Catholics. So that's probably relevant for us to think about. He busted other myths in their survey of 1,200 randomly selected congregations. The region of the country had no effect on the diversity of the congregations, apparently. And the theology of the congregation didn't seem to matter particularly either to how multiracial they were. Upon examination in this study, the ability or inability of whites, this is the most devastating to his thesis. Upon examination in this study, the ability or inability of whites in multiracial congregations to recognize and then address issues of systemic injustice seems little different from that of their counterparts in uniracial congregations. So this hope that entering into a network in a multiracial congregation would suddenly open the eyes of its participants doesn't seem to be borne out. You can do just as well if you're in an all-white congregation, apparently, or just as badly. Emerson writes that whites, and he creates this category of sixth Americans. These are the harbingers of hope for America. Even these whites in these multiracial congregations draw the line at giving up power and are unlikely to support policies designed to reduce inequality. And then it just, this is the final nail in the coffin, I think. The latest book in this series is by Coryell Edwards, who worked on this one. She's an African-American sociologist at Ohio State. She found in her study The Elusive Dream, again, muted colors, The Power of Race in Interracial Churches, this came out last year, that even if you can find, a successful, sustained interracial congregation, these congregations tend to reinforce white hegemony. So Emerson on the back writes, "We may wish it were not so, but it's a reality that must be faced." So that's the story of this particular line of scholarship. I think it's pretty interesting. So I think the mistake that Emerson is making is confusing the prophetic witness of multiracial congregations, the call that we should all be in open friendship and worshiping together. I think he confuses that with a practical strategy for overcoming racial injustice in society. This is not the same thing. If you succeed against all odds in holding together a multiracial congregation, do not be surprised when America's original sin, the sin of racism, makes the task extremely difficult and is just as present in your multiracial congregation as it is outside the walls. So in the light of this 10 years of research, I hate to say this, perhaps the place to start is to stop American churches and white evangelicals in particular being part of the problem. This may be a better place to start. Let's stop churches being part of the problem rather than heralding them as the solution. And I think that's why Mission Mississippi is an important organization to study and watch. If it is a revolution at all, it is a very quiet revolution, as I said, but it is the legacy of John Perkins just as much as the CCDA movement. And the sacrifices that people like Dolphus Wiry are making in not addressing the hard issues up front enables them to move a large mass of the white churches forward incrementally, but they are moving them. As problematic as that is, and I'm not pretending that isn't highly problematic. So that's about all I have to say right now.
I just wanted you to say, expand your last sentence. They are moving them.
They are moving them.
What movements do you see towards addressing the injustices that come from this?
Well, in my research, I was sort of desperately trying to find some evidence that Mississippi was being changed one relationship at a time, right? Mission Mississippi talks about kind of the importance of church partnerships, and the ones I investigated didn't really have much weight to them. Talked about relationships that were being formed in their businessmen's prayers breakfast and giving access to sort of breaking a glass ceiling for African-American entrepreneurs. And there was some evidence that was happening. But then I sort of finished with kind of a sort of somewhat depressing conclusion. And then Katrina hit. And suddenly, these guys, Dolphus Wiry, Jenkins, all of the African-American leaders, they're continuing side projects. They've got other nonprofits that are doing community development work. And what they did was, Mission Mississippi had this amazing network of connections between white and black churches, particularly on the Gulf Coast. And then they also had these connections with larger Christian aid agencies. And actually, Mission Mississippi became the coordinator of a large part of aid to the Gulf Coast, faith-based aid to the Gulf Coast. And you sort of saw a glimpse of this kind of work that Dolphus Wiry was doing, setting up these connections, and then actually it being leveraged to do something that really addressed kind of, if you can call Hurricane Katrina a systemic issue, but it revealed systemic problems, and FEMA listed them as one of the key agencies to contact to figure out what to do. Of course, just because FEMA says that's important, probably don't know how much weight you put on that. And then it's all gone sort of quiet again, right? So I sort of really emphasize that this is a quiet revolution. I think Katrina showed a glimpse of the power of this network that's being built. Simply the involvement of how many churches are open, opening their pulpits and inviting these people in to speak. It's very easy to dismiss that, but actually in Mississippi that's pretty huge. When I was down in Jackson last month, though, and I was asking questions about how Obama's election had sort of played out in these developing chapters in Mississippi, and Nettie Winters told me the story that in one town, a group had been meeting for 8 years. They'd, black and white, they'd been involved in habitat projects and building things together, but the whites all walked out after the election of Obama. They said the African Americans were being triumphalistic. They couldn't be a part of this organization anymore. So that's all the issues of power sort of come up. So I don't know is the answer. I just think watching them is very important. I'm not holding them up as having the answer, but I think part of it is people like Dolphus Weary are people I have a huge amount of respect for. And if he says this is really important, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, right? And the lived theology kind of angle is to sort of step away from the arrogance, the sort of deconstructionism of the academy, right? I want to go and learn from these saints and find out why it is that they say this is really important, and then reflect on that. So, yeah, this is my book isn't a how-to book, like some of these guys. It's not a how to do this. It's sort of a reflection on what these people are actually doing.
So yours would be one of the great covers?
I don't know what my cover is. They haven't shown me yet. I'll have rainbows and butterflies on mine. So.
I have a question in relation to Thornwell's theology. And I want to start and end with East End Fellowship's presentation about Richmond yesterday. Where they ended their presentation in relation to Mississippi dynamics. They ended their presentation saying, we are focusing our work on location rather than identity and choice in church relations. So you are organizing parishes, you focus, or small groups where you focus on a community rather than have the choice through identity to make affiliation. Now, what I'm going to go here is, I'm going to ask a complex question because I think it gets close to some of the dynamics I've heard you talking about in Mississippi. And that is, what happens when church affiliation is not related to location but to identity? And I think Thornwell's theology comes out of what William Cavanaugh describes as happening in the Middle Ages in his article on Wars of Religion and the Rise of the Nation State, where he says, in relation to the transition that happened there, the concept of religion being born here is one of domesticated belief systems, which are, insofar as possible, to be manipulated by the sovereign for the benefit of the state. Religion is no longer a matter of certain bodily practices within the body of Christ, think CCDA, but it is limited to the realm of the soul, think Thornwell, and the body is handed over to the state. That is, there has been a profound bifurcation in our nation-state faith-identity dynamic in Western Protestantism that creates these affinity separations where it's very easy for racism to take root. And so we replicate that dynamic in our church lives in every location we're at. We relate over affinity rather than location. So my question is, in light of Cavanaugh, in light of what you've laid out, in light of what East End Fellowship is trying to do, my question is, and the failures of this Habitat project you just named after Obama's election, where identity and affinity were challenged, is the work of SILT, CCDA, some of the groups represented here, trying to reclaim that corporate identity for the church, which was lost in a sense, in the Middle Ages, in its Catholic sense, and I'm saying that as a Mennonite, but wanting to acknowledge that there is a profound affinity that was assumed in that parish identity where you live together, you have to relate together, somehow in the way of Christ, failing or not. So my question is there a process of reclaiming that space of the Spirit that is local that we heard in John Perkins's, not John Perkins's emphasis, that we heard in East End Fellowship's work, that is, and I will conclude now, that is directly related to the last image in Scripture where the river of life flows from the throne of God and the leaves of the trees beside that river are for the healing of the nations, the peoples. The exact image is for the healing of the peoples. And I sense that that is or isn't happening in your description of what was going on in Mississippi.
Yes. No, really, really well put. I mean, I think for me the question is, I mean, I see CCDA and these intentional communities and in communities that I've been a part of as much more of a prophetic witness rather than a pragmatic strategy, right? The gospel is not terribly pragmatic, and that's glorious, right? It's not, it confounds, you know, the wisdom of the wise, right? It's foolishness. When you move to a project which is trying to change something at the state, when I say state level, I mean that kind of scale, I think you can call upon the prophetic witness of these communities as an example, as a kind of light, an endpoint. But I think it's a mistake to expect this to be the pragmatic starting point for changing society, right? Because clearly, I mean, if in one example a multiracial congregation is the way you can go, we know that it's almost definitely going to fail, statistically, if you can find one. Sorry, I'll speak that word of encouragement into your lives. but the point is, you're engaged in a glorious prophetic task, right? Right? But where is the starting point? I mean, what I see is, I mean, the phrase moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. You know, are we just? Well, what I see the sort of if you're proposing multiracial congregations as the solution, as these guys are doing, what you're doing is, as the Titanic is going down, you're drawing up blueprints for a really great new ocean liner, right? But it's not going to save the people on the ship in the immediate. Maybe I'm just too pragmatic, I don't know. I think what you have to be doing is figuring out what you can do. Another sort of metaphor is the one, is more biblical, right, is the one of wineskins. And what Emerson finds is that the best chance of, now here's good news, best chance of success for a multiracial congregation is if it's a completely new congregation that's set up intentionally to do this. And so that's what you're saying, right? Finding it has to be a rediscovery or discarding of this old wineskin. Problem in America is most of the wineskins are old. And people aren't going to leave those old wineskins. So you either give up on those people in a sort of emergent church kind of way, you know, see it, we're going to be a new congregation. But you're going to become an old wineskin eventually. Or you have to come up with a strategy that in some ways is a compromise, which is how much new wine can I get into these old wineskins and start changing it that way? How can I work with the wineskins that we have? The results are less satisfying. The results seem less prophetic and less dramatic. But I think the people who are doing it, people like Dolphus Weary, are being extremely faithful to their calling. So that's where I'm at. Sorry, it's unsatisfying. I haven't got a solution. I don't.
Can I do a quick follow up on that comment about the new congregation? Keep it short.
Sure, please. Yeah.
That was, I think, the model that we're following and what we try to do in Cambridge. And it worked to an extent in that we started a new congregation. Our church planting team was 7, was ethnically diverse. you still saw some of the old patterns slip in because people were bringing some of their congregational ecclesiological baggage. The difficulty for us was actually the two barriers that emerged out of that. One was the class issue, because we were in Cambridge drawing from Harvard MIT students. We had the range of ethnicities, but they were all college-educated, master's and doctorate degrees. Mm-hmm. And so their view of understanding racial justice was very different. And when we started working with at-risk youth, it became, all right, now we have a different socioeconomic milieu going on there. That was a very difficult hurdle to create. I think we've, after I left, something has changed where some of the youth have now become young adults who are now becoming more integrated into the church, but that was a huge barrier. So the class issue was a really tough one when we started trying to do some of these new wineskins. So I mean, that's, I think that is the way to go in terms of new work. What we saw in our denomination, and this is something that I'm kind of advocating for, is the dying, it's what I'm writing about, the dying white churches need to seed into these new churches. And they need to be willing to say, all right, we're going to shut our doors. We've got 15 people in a back room. We're going to shut our doors. We're going to turn this money over to a young congregation that's vibrant. We saw this in our denomination at a church in Seattle called Quest. The host congregation of 50 people, very pretty stable congregation, 50 people, you had enough money to last another 20 years. They were housing a multi-ethnic congregation led by Korean American, 400 young people mostly. They merged in with the new congregation, turned over their building, did away with their old name, took on the Quest name. The senior pastor of the old church became the associate pastor, and the young 30-something Korean-American senior pastor became the pastor of the whole congregation. You know, they gave a $5 million building over to a new congregation. So, I mean, those are models that I like to see a little bit more,
sure,
where the previous generation, mostly of white churches with beautiful downtown buildings, willing to pass that on to younger congregations.
I think what picture we see, or what picture we have in front of us, and I think the work of Maltman would beg us to dream and continue to put that picture out there. And I think that's a good example of, you know, no one would expect someone to hand over a congregation. But I think it's that kind of radical decisions that need to be made, and we need to think about what do we really want to see? Do we just want to see someone in our pulpit? Do we just want to have a relationship with someone who's other than us? And those are all really good and great things, and they need to happen. But what is the, where is it going? And if heaven is that picture, then more radical things like that, I think, would take place. So I think what we want to see is a question that I would rhetorically ask us, ourselves, to chew on.
I think one thing I'd like to add, I mean, why did I have that kind of little exposition of Maltman in the middle, is when you look at this stuff, particularly from the sociologists, all this talk about friendship seems, we need to let that go, right? Let's just be friends. We're kind of like, you know, the relationship that breaks up. Can we still be friends? And we heard Dr. Perkins, you know, a student asked him the other night, you know, what should I do? Seek out somebody of a different race and be intentional about forming a relationship with them. Well, Emerson Smith would say, that's not gonna change anything. But what I wanted to show was that theologically, there is a very robust place to start talking about friendship. So that was kind of my purpose in doing that.
Two more questions. Okay. Barry and then Ashley.
Yeah, I think I liked what I heard you doing at the end, and in response to Roy's question, moving from a category for measuring success from transforming society to an effective witness. I think I like that, but I'm not any more encouraged by what you've described as even being an effective witness. And what I mean by that is, you know, as soon as you start talking witness, I start thinking of the Mennonites, right? And Mennonite witness is, it seems to me as an outsider observing it and probably idealizing it, is grounded in a shared economic life, right? I mean, it's not a witness of people gathering from their various workplaces for a Sunday morning of prayer. It's coming together from their shared...
sharing all things in common.
Sharing all things. That's a powerful witness. I don't expect it to transform society because I think the principalities and powers are far too powerful yet. But I do find that a powerful witness, whereas I don't find interracial worship apart from, you know, taking the Eucharist out into the everyday lives of those congregations. I don't find that a particularly exciting witness. Does that make any sense?
Yes. I just think it's the family we're stuck with. I think there's a sort of a very Protestant urge to keep splitting until you can get the perfect kind of congregation or the true gospel. But if we take seriously that we are the body of Christ, then we've got to accept it with all its members. So you can either pull the sort of sectarian reforming move of saying, well, if you close your doors to people of a different race, then you are no longer the church, right? It's a status confessionis, right? Or you can say, I heard someone at Baptist talking about that we're all part of the same family. It's just we've got some really embarrassing relatives, and so trying to figure out what it is to actually work and stay in communion with those really embarrassing relatives. And I think that's what Mission Mississippi's doing. I think, and you see it even within their leadership. I mean, the patience of some of these African American leaders with their white board members, probably they deserve gold medals, right? But they see that you have to stay, that they would say you have to stay with this vision of the unity of the body of Christ and not cast people out.
Isn't that yet another example, though, of the African-American community having to submit and give up to a white-driven agenda where these white pastors are saying, this is what we feel comfortable with, this is the way we operate, therefore...
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, I think that's a real problem, and that's why John Perkins is incredibly dismissive of them. I would like to think that there's perhaps something a little more cunning, sort of cunning as serpents, going on, that there's a long-term objective of these guys to really, on a pragmatic level, leverage just as, I mean, this is something they've learned from John Perkins, leveraging the capital of these white churches, whether you can, even if you can only get them to shift incrementally, if you take their money, for whatever reason, paternalistic or whatever they're giving you, you can take that money and use it. So, it's a perilous enterprise, right? It's not very pure. Yeah.
I'll make this quick. Sorry. First of all, thank you so much. This was really incredible to hear about. I really wanted to trade a little bit on May Cannon's comment from the open discussion yesterday. It just continues to plague me, I think, in hearing about a lot of these efforts at reconciliation. And I work a lot with college students, and I think especially a lot of the African-American female students who are moving into divinity school and moving into community development efforts, and hearing them feel like they're forced to choose a lot of times because the opportunities and the conversations in CCDA, hearing them express grief and it feeling difficult to move into these places. I would love to hear what your thoughts are about why it seems like gender isn't a part of that particular conversation at Mission Mississippi and what that is about. And
no, gender is absolutely part of the conversation, and it's part of the it's part of the very conservative church culture down there. In their early days, they organized father conferences for fathers. culturally they are sort of captive to a sort of patriarchal system. And it was difficult. It was kind of funny when I'm just going through the edits and, you know, there's this question of I'm not using inclusive language, right? I'm saying chairman and businessman. And I'm like, no, that's that's staying there because that is actually, they have the businessman's prayer meeting and businessmen go to it. And it's the men. So, again, just hugely problematic. So. Sorry, I'm sorry. I need to say something happy. Oh yeah, that's right. Right, okay, thank you. But as in, the history of the evangelical church, when you actually get to see who's doing the work, right, there are the women. I mean, and the importance, and actually the chairperson of the prayer committee is a woman.
Yeah.
Right, Sherry Tynes. Interesting enough, she goes to First Baptist Church, Jackson, and the First Baptist Church won't support Mission Mississippi, but her son—they've allowed her Sunday school at First Baptist to officially endorse Mission Mississippi, which is kind of strange.
I'm just going to say it would be interesting to apply Altman's Center for Open Friendship to generally gender relations.
Right, and his wife does Elizabeth Maltman Wendell's book on friendship, sort of takes off from that point, and I mean it's a feminist use of that, and the title of the Christological title of friend is very useful for in feminist stuff because it's not gendered. Yeah.
I think the critique to the academic conversation in this regard is that when we identify the problem, gender is not included in the problem. That it's always a tag on. Yesterday, kind of raised the point about it. Every one of those books. As you say, there aren't congregations around the country that are successfully living out multi-ethnicity, let alone class, mm-hmm. let alone gender. And in fact, mm-hmm. I find the multi-ethnic congregations are often more exclusive of women than the monoculture congregations. And so my right. encouragement to us as mm-hmm. a group is, as we dialogue about these things, to not have gender be something that's an addendum. I mean, even your comment about his wife, really, I care less about women talking about this issue and care more about men. It's not my task. Do you know? I mean, men are the ones that have the issue with the fact that I'm in leadership. I don't have a problem with it. Unless God messed up in terms of his giftedness, right? So, I mean, I guess my encouragement to you men is mm-hmm. Include even the question of the role of women as we talk about what it means to live out a holistic community, that's...
Right, absolutely, and even it's actually impossible to think about kind of racial dynamics in America without thinking about gender.
And yet we do.
Sure.
In those books.
Yeah. Right.
And
right.
Yet we do.
Mm-hmm. I would like to say that coming up in African American church, African American Baptist church, and even though, and this doesn't speak for all the churches, but even though the men pastor the church. From what I've seen, the families that have strong families, it's the strength of the woman that actually provided a lot of the foundation, and from what I see today, still provide a lot of the foundation, not only for the husband who's kind of running the business of the church, but also they're the ones that take up the slack when the husband is not, they have to kind of run the business of the church the same way they do with the family. So even though it's not talked about a lot, I know within what I came from, that was kind of the model, and that was what we followed in the way of church, family, and all the things that are associated with that. Because I did come from a family of strong believers. Believed in the church and his plan was in their own
Right, and Mission Mississippi, their key thing is to try and get everybody to stay in the boat. And this leads to real, I mean, problematic compromises that they know. I mean, initially some people left because Catholics were on the board, but they stood firm on that one. They had their, when they started, they had their pastors and wives annual banquet. And now it's pastors and spouses. And so, you know, they're sort of accommodating. But these touch, I mean, it's the if you want to do race and ecumenism at the same time, I mean, you know.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, you know, as a black woman, so both, I see them as two totally separate subjects. Both, the strongholds are both as intense. I mean, the metaphor that came to my mind is, you know, and I'm not a historian, but, you know, World War II, right? We fought in Europe and we fought in Asia. Same war, but two totally different geographies. And fighting. So I guess what I'm saying is, when you're talking about race, to me, it's okay to not in the same sentence talk about gender. It's they're right. Both as big, they're both as problematic, but they're two totally different issues historically. You know, the reason why we have segregated churches is a totally different reason why women aren't in the pulpit. It's separate, and they're both as big and they're both as important, but. You have to be able to talk about one and not feel obligated to talk about the other at the same time.
Well, certainly, when the more issues you try and talk about simultaneously, the harder it becomes to have any kind of conversation and actually keep the people there. Right. That's a pragmatic choice. Now, this is me, not Mission Mississippi. If you're trying to sort of embody an ecclesiology of open friendship, these are all deeply connected, right? The exclusion of anybody from your service, from your church body, is hugely problematic. But again, it's the difference between sort of prophetic witness and okay, well, let's have a pragmatic strategy here.
And I feel like personally, I've been fighting both wars, being
right.
A black woman in ministry. So I understand taking up this weapon over here and taking up this weapon over here, and they are all inclusive. But I guess what I'm saying is. Being black and being a woman are two. What am I trying to say? Well, if you're both, you have to fight both wars.
Right.
But there's two separate reasons theologically why women aren't allowed in the pulpit in some churches and why black people aren't in some white churches. It's two separate reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, historically, they come from different strongholds.
Yeah.
No,
thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd like to just add one point, and that is just, and that is to remind us of the setting and the plot line of the story. In 1963, in Mississippi, during the months preceding the 1964 Freedom Summer Project, there was a period. A little-known campaign seeking to segregate the church is called the Church Visits Campaign. There were similar campaigns in other cities and towns around the South. But Ed King and Medgar Evers had conceived of this, and it involved groups of black and white students going Sunday after Sunday to the mainline churches, First Presbyterian, First Baptist, Jackson, seeking to be allowed into the closed doors of the church. And Sunday after Sunday, these groups would enter in, if they had a chance to make a case, a conversation with the so-called church guards. These are ushers, deacons, who are in a sense deputized to make sure that no interracial groups or people of color, unless these, an exception, were Africans evangelized by the churches, but even these churches would be difficult, and turn them away. And they would be turned away with the response that, you know, this is the Church of Jesus Christ, we're going to keep it that way, integration has nothing to do with the gospel, et cetera, et cetera. And often there would be a police wagon at the corner of the street, and they would hand the church ushers, the groups of church testers, over to the police, and they would be taken off and arrested. And there are interesting affidavits on this. The closed doors of the church, white churches of Mississippi, never opened in 1963. And they never opened until Mission Mississippi began its work in 1992. And so this may sound like such a modest a movement from our perspective. What I think is, we need to remember the narrative context, the historical context of this, and to see this as a kind of getting about the business, unfinished business of the civil rights movement, and understand it in that context is my only point at this juncture.
And Mission Mississippi, with that, as they go out, and so they've got a preaching team that preaches throughout the year in different churches, they're still being the first time an African American is preaching in these white pulpits.
Thanks. And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought, but what I was going to say was, do we have anything like that in Charlottesville? I mean, this hub of, intellectual life, and we went Obama, and we're so progressive, and we've got Earth stickers in our cars, and we fly all the right banners. But it's perhaps humbling to us to think, oh, in this state, in Mississippi, we see an innovative experiment in church-based interracialism that, quite frankly, I don't see happening anywhere else in the United States. So,
well, we did that before you got back.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Well, what happened?
I mean, there were churches that were swapping pulpits, Trinity, First Baptist, Christ mm-hmm. Community, and worshiping together. But it just kind of eventually fell flat.
Impact is multiracial justice in this yeah.
And it's still fairly new.
Five years.
5 years or something.
Yeah.
So it's still...
When First Baptist Maine on Ebenezer moved First Baptist Park Street, White Church helped them move, and there was significant help in other ways in the building. So, I mean, there have been a lot of things happening.
But an intentional effort that really has all the congregations on board with a very ambitious slate of programs. You didn't even go into the minutia of that. I mean, the beauty of this is really in the kind of particularity of the details. Breakfast, gatherings, restaurants in Jackson were saying, look, if you come to our restaurant with a black or a white group, we'll give you 40% off on the buffet, And all of these things, we were talking about dozens and dozens and dozens of very particular, sort of unsexy, hard to see ways in which...
There's nothing unsexy about Shoney's breakfast buffet.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah. And so why is this happening?
There is an impact clergy meeting that meets interracial clergy meet behind the scenes in Charlottesville to work not just on impact but other issues.
Yeah, but what's the congregational impact of that?
There are a lot of market conversations and public exchange, but there's no network like this.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, I got going a little bit. Hey, this is great. Thank you very much. Let's take a 15-minute break, and what we'll do then is move into small groups, I would like to call your attention to the small groups, and it's a few people are not have not been assigned or placed in a small group.